Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our consciousness and how we, as a collective society, are moving into a greater spiritual awareness, and that includes our bodies, our minds, our souls, our sexuality, our awakening, and includes all the things that people on this program have been talking about how consciousness is evolving. So I'm actually here in Los Angeles. I just attended the Conscious Living Expo. I've met some beautiful people there, including my guest today, Alora Anana. And I am at her temple home. Is this Marina Del Rey? In Marina Del Rey, and she has created a beautiful space. And she has some very interesting perspectives, very revolutionary, insightful, uplifting ideas about the divine feminine, about the interactions between men and women, about the transformation of culture in general. Hi, Alora.
Hello, Alan. Thank you so much for coming to my temple and taking this time with me.
Yeah, no, we were talking last night and you were saying some very interesting things. Of course, I was exhausted and passing out, but your whole, it's sort of like a new mythology of living. I mean, myth in the sense that myths are real and they are the kind of archetypes of consciousness. So where should we start? Should we start with the idea of the divine feminine? Or where would you like to start in your whole overview of what you want to present to the world?
Well, I think starting with the divine feminine is the right place because really, for me, there was my life before that experience, and then there was my life afterwards. So,
what was the experience, the bad experience?
That experience was doing ayahuasca in the late 80s as a young mother with children and a husband and, a somewhat conscious but not really awakened life. Mm-hmm. And then having in the 2 years of work that I did with the shaman working with ayahuasca and other materials, I had a visitation by who I would now believe to be the Green Tara, but I didn't even know the Green Tara existed. I just knew that there was a divine feminine being that had come to be with me, and she was green, and she had jewels all over her body, but she had no attention on them. And she was so loving and so beautiful and so compassionate. And in later years, as I spoke about her, we actually have a film of a moment, probably 10 years later, when I was just sharing the story of it. And she actually comes through again and interrupts the energy field of the recording so that the recording's going along, and all of a sudden it goes, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then I'm out of control in ecstasy with this energy that's coming in. So then,
on the recording,
I can show it to you.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, she comes through you. Are you like channeling her, or?
Well, in that experience, what I really feel happened is that in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, as I worked with the shaman, there were times when I felt myself laying there, and I knew there was a team of angelic beings operating on my mind and rewiring me, and I could feel these delicate movements going on, and I knew I was safe, and I knew something was happening. So, and what began to happen for me then was my dancer woke up. I'd always loved dance, but I wasn't dancing. I didn't dance things. Now I completely live in cat suits and I dress every single day, all day long, in the divine feminine.
You're the embodiment.
I am living it. I am doing it. It's been 20 years, really.
Yes, you had this great experience with Green Tara in the ayahuasca, but what is the divine feminine? I mean, how do we embrace it? How does it show up? I mean, I know you're transforming the culture with it, but what is it?
Well, I don't know how to answer the what is it, but let's say the time that I really want to point to where it became the focus of my life was probably 1994. So maybe 4 years after I'd had this experience with the Green Tara, so that dance awakened in me, I began to yearn for and hunger for the kind of time that women really need. Before that, I was just very much in the mode of being a businesswoman and having children and a house and buying good housekeeping and just, you know, being a normal woman.
You were totally regular, but a totally regular woman doesn't do ayahuasca.
That's right. So I was a totally regular woman, except that I had done the S training in the early 70s, and I was fairly conscious.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't spiritual,
mm-hmm.
but I was conscious. And I also was familiar. My husband and I used mm-hmm. marijuana on a frequent basis as a part of our sexual life and as a part of our ability to look together at problems we were having and see them from a higher perspective. So I wasn't normal in that I did have a positive relationship with marijuana. And then in the late 80s, we had been married 7 or 8 years. We were facing some major financial and emotional challenges, and people who knew us referred us to this shaman. And, you know, I had not done any of those. I'd never done ecstasy. I'd never done LSD. I'd never done any of those things. So taking ayahuasca was like jumping in full force.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a huge and profound experience for both of us, and, you know, awakened us spiritually, no question about
mm-hmm.
it. And then our lives began to be about that. And so we ended up leading a very powerful course called The Mind of Love, Essential Teachings in Relationships. And it was while I was in the middle of leading that course and very happy with my life that I encountered the mythology of the goddess Inanna. And that word is spelled I-N-A-N-N-A. And what is so important to me about the story of Inanna is that Inanna is humanity's original goddess of love. She's the first time humanity revered a deity for not just being a fertile, fecund, big-breasted goddess, but being beauty and being allure and being the transformative aspect.
And intelligence.
And intelligence. And a sexual, but not so much about procreation, but about pleasure. So the poetry, what staggered me was that we have the mythology translated from the language of the time, on cuneiform tablets from 5,000 years ago. And when you read that mythology, it's amazing to hear, first of all, the myths and realize that the things that they were working with intellectually and in their own spiritual process were the same things we're working with now.
Mm-hmm.
So the myths have application to our current lives. And they also reveal what I call language before sexual shame. Because I never realized until I heard that language that anytime I speak, I am speaking on top of and piercing through the prohibition against speaking about sexuality.
Mm.
So
still, even since the 60s, there's still a prohibition?
If I'm gonna sit here on the radio and talk about my vulva, I have to go through a little thing that goes, that's not normal. You know, there is some...
What would
bravery.
You say about your vulva?
Well, I don't have much to say about it, frankly, but let's just say Inanna did.
Okay.
You know, the story starts off with her leaning back against the apple tree, admiring her wondrous vulva. So,
really?
That's exactly
in the ancient Babylonian myth?
It's right there. In fact, Roger Kahn, would you go get that red book in my book?
I would love to hear that right here on the radio, reading about it.
It's amazing. Because, yeah. See, my mission mm-hmm. is to be a beautiful, elegant, intelligent, conscious, spiritual woman who is fully sexual.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that what is at the root of most of our problems is the split between spirit and sex.
Okay.
And my mission has been to model that you can be all those things. You can be beautiful, elegant, intelligent, conscious, and spiritual, and fully on that sexual power. And so that's my...
But when you say fully sexual, it doesn't mean you have to have sex all the time, does it?
No, it just means that you are fully embracing the power of that within yourself,
mm-hmm.
and you're not eschewing it. If you think about our models of, try and show me even an actress who really carries the level of spiritual elegance and intelligence and full sexuality, and it's hard to find it.
You don't think anyone out there does? Well, maybe Susan Sarandon.
Maybe Susan Sarandon, but let's just say, for example, you know, Glenn Close and Meryl Streep,
no.
They don't, right? And most of the women who are sort of more in the sexual genre, they don't really seem to have the depth. I am, you know, passionate about the depth of wisdom that comes when you really embrace this part of yourself.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking of some actresses. Jennifer Lawrence, young, beautiful, in touch with something. And the woman who was in The Wolf of Wall Street. Did you see that movie?
You know, I haven't been watching movies recently,
okay.
So I think I don't know the young ones. But let's just say about that is that they're young.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I'm now 65. So to carry this energy all the way through my life and into my senior years, I just had a great experience at the Living Expo of a woman who came up with a new word called MAGA.
Mm-hmm.
So a magus or a magus is the male version of a magician, and a maga is the female. And she's saying, you know, we used to have maiden, mother, crone, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now we're going to have maiden, mother, maga, crone.
Mm.
So women in my age range, which really don't feel, crone is sort of going into the death years, and we're nowhere close to that.
Right.
So to have a new word that represents this stage of life when you are finally freed completely of any concerns about reproduction, you're really pretty much freed of any concerns about making your mark in the world and with family and children and all those things. So we are now, for the very first time as women, powerfully coming into our own in our 50s and 60s. And so to be a MAGA at this time, what I see is that the young women are passionate about meeting me because it's the first time they're seeing a woman at this age that looks like she's still juicy and alive and something you want to grow into.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the
purpose,
is to have something you want to grow into.
So from there, we're going now, what, 5,000 years into the past? About, what, 3,000-4,000 years back to ancient
Sumeria,
the
Inanna, queen of heaven and earth, her stories and hymns from Sumer.
Oh.
And it's written by Diane Wolfstein, who is a folklorist,
yes.
And Samuel Noah Kramer, who is an anthropologist.
Okay.
So it's a collaboration between them. And this is the story that grabbed me and took me and claimed my life, really, because there was my life before the night I read this story,
okay.
And there was my life afterwards.
So this is from the ancient cuneiform text that was written in Sumer probably at least 3,000, 4,000 years ago.
Exactly.
Okay, this is a Laura reading.
So this is the myth called Inanna and the God of Wisdom. In this myth, Inanna is about an 18-year-old young queen, and she's going out to test her powers, and she decides she's going to go visit Enki, the god of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how the poem starts. Inanna placed the shugura, the crown of the step, on her head. She went to the sheepfold, to the shepherd. She leaned back against the apple tree. When she leaned against the apple tree, her vulva was wondrous to behold. Rejoicing at her wondrous vulva, the young woman Inanna applauded herself.
Well, she's like the Earth goddess, though, too, in a sense, right? I mean, it's her own physical human physiology, but there's a, you know, because it's mythic, it's the Earth itself that's feminine. Anyway, that's what I get.
Well, that's a good interpretation. I haven't thought of that before. But what I was so blown away by was just what? I mean, it was like, wait a minute. Who talks like this?
Mm-hmm.
When did women ever think like this, talk like this? When were they ever free like this? And the thought that that had been possible staggered me.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a great story. It's actually a precursor. Remember in Raiders of the Lost Ark where you had the woman and the man having a beer challenge where they were drinking and toasting and challenging? And remember that whole thing? Well, in this mythology, this is one of the parts of this, but this is a long story. We're not going to read the whole story here, but I'm going to read.
Oh, I see. They drank together. Enki and Inanna drank beer together.
Yeah, they drank more beer together. They drank more and more beer together. With their bronze vessels filled to overflowing, with the vessels of Yurash, mother of the earth, they toasted each other, they challenged each other. Enki, swaying with drink, toasted Inanna. In the name of my power, in the name of my holy shrine, to my daughter Inanna, I shall give the high priesthood, godship, the noble enduring crown, the throne of kingship. Inanna replied, I take them. So he keeps giving her his powers, and she keeps taking them, and 14 times he raises his cup to her and gives her what are called the holy me. And the holy me were the civilizing understanding of, it was the understanding of civilization. Because if you remember, Sumeria is called the cradle of civilization. Mm-hmm. And before Sumeria, we were basically kind of like wild nomads. Mm-hmm. And now we begin to create city-states and to have laws and to have civilization. And this is the story of all the gifts of civilization. This is what he gave her, and it's listed. You know, it's a long, long list.
But it starts with the priesthood, the high priesthood.
He gave me the high priesthood. He gave me godship. He gave me the noble enduring crown. He gave me the throne of kingship.
This is an interesting one, though. He gave me the kissing of the phallus.
And he gave me the art of lovemaking. He gave me the kissing of the phallus. He gave me the art of prostitution. He gave me the art of speeding.
What's speeding?
I don't know.
But this is like, she's like making it all okay, prostitution,
because
all that.
Because it wasn't ever not okay at this time. See, that's what I'm saying to you. This is before it wasn't okay.
Well, he gave me the cult. He gave me the cult prostitute.
That's right. He gave. So I'm not sure when she says the cult prostitute, if she means the sacred prostitute. But my guess is that's what she means.
Uh-huh.
Because there is a difference, there's a distinction in those times between the sacred prostitute and the profane prostitute.
Oh.
The sacred prostitute is serving in the temples and is really the high priestess of the community as a source of wisdom and you know, spiritual teaching. So the sacred prostitute is a very high position in the culture, whereas the profane prostitute is more just going to be at the tavern serving men's needs. But it's a different thing.
So if this is a mythological tale, I mean, maybe it's in fact true, but I'm talking about society, the society of Sumer at the time must have been open to all this. So because Inanna represents the height of that civilization, then what do you think, if you can tune in, the culture of that time who worshipped Inanna and these traits that were given to her, what would that have looked like if we can just play with our imagination?
Well, what I want to do is give you another myth to hear it from.
Okay.
Because what's really wonderful about Inanna is that the four main myths, they apply to a woman's life right now. The very first myth is she's about 13 or 14. She's coming into her puberty, and she wants a bed and a throne. So those are the basic elements of power. You need a bed to sleep in and procreate from, and you need a throne to sit on and decree. So she's a young queen. That's what she needs.
Mm-hmm.
Then at the age of about 18, she's going to get wisdom. And she, in the story that we were just reading, how that story unfolds is that he gives her all of his wisdom, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then in the morning, we'll read this little part. It's very fun to hear. It says, when the beer had gone out from the one who had drunk beer, when the beer had gone out from Father Enki, when the beer had gone out from the great god of wisdom, he looked about the Abzu. And he realizes he's given everything away to her.
Oh.
And, you know, he's not happy about it. And he decides he wants it back. And he sends his sukal, which is a word that kind of is a special word in Sumeria. It means your vizier, your wise counselor, your magician who can do, you know, things that you can't do. It's a very wonderful term. I actually took it as my legal last name at a certain time in my life.
So, Sukel.
But at any rate, what happens in the story is that Enki sends his Sukal Isimu to go get these things back from her. And she, when he comes, he says to her, "You know your father's law, word is law in the universe. It must be obeyed." And she says, "What else does he want to give me?" And he says, "Oh, well, he says you can go on home on your own, but we're going to take all these things back." Mm-hmm. And she says to him, "My father has changed his word to me. He has violated his pledge, broken his promise. Deceitfully, my father spoke to me. Deceitfully, he cried in the name of my power, in the name of my holy shrine. Deceitfully, he sent you to me." And so she says, "No, I'm not giving it up." And then there, her Sukal and his Sukal start having, they start having, they start trying, they're using their magic powers. Who's going to get command of what's in the boat? Because it's on the boat and it's sailing back to her world. And they go through this series of they send Lahama monsters, they send the sound-piercing Kugelgal, and every single time, no matter what Enki sends, Inanna's Sukal is victorious. And finally, they get to her hometown, and her Sukal tells her, cause a celebration in the town. Let the streets run with water. Tell everybody come down. We're going to unload something magic. Come get a celebration going. And when Enki really sees what she's doing, and he sees that as she unloads the boat, this is what I think is so symbolic in here. She unloads the boat, and she unloads everything she got from Enki, and then more appears. It's the feminine that he couldn't give her. So through this process of going to get wisdom, she not only gained the wisdom that he could give her, but she gained the feminine wisdom that he couldn't give her.
Mm.
So in that part, we talk about Inanna brought the placing of the garment on the ground. She brought allure. She brought the art of women. She brought the perfect execution of the knee, which is the organizing principle. She brought the tigi and lili drums, the uga, the mez, and the ala tambourine. So what happens finally in the end of this myth is Enki realizes that she deserves the wisdom, that she is not only has she received what he gave her, but she's actually expanded it. And so then he aligns with her, and he decrees that they will be allies. So that's how this myth ends.
Mm.
It ends with the masculine honoring the feminine. Okay.
I see. What was the city that she lived in? Was it Uruk?
Uruk. Eridu is, hers is Uruk, and he is in Eridu.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the most ancient cities. They actually exist. There are, ruins of these cities around. Now, we're going to go from here to the world's first love story. Okay.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And this is the courtship of Inanna and Dumuzi. And what I want to read from you here is, again, language before sexual shame. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you hear this, you will realize we are a far cry from this time, even now.
So, Inanna, was she pre-Isis? Was she before?
She was pre-Isis. She is what's called the goddess. Before the goddess was particularized.
Mm.
So before you had the goddess of grain and the goddess of this and the goddess of that, Inanna was all of it. She was a mother without being lost in her mothering. She was a wife without being lost in her wifing. She was fully sexual. She was both warrior and lover. She became Ishtar, and then she became Aphrodite, and she became Isis. So all the whole lineage of the goddess of love starts with Inanna.
You know, Easter's named after Ishtar.
I didn't know that.
Yes, it's a celebration of Ishtar.
Well, I'll tell you what's so amazing to me is that when I first encountered this, I just thought it was wonderful that we had the real record from the time of this goddess.
Mm-hmm.
But my life since that time has come to reveal to me that Inanna is actually a part of this whole Palladian mystery, and that if you read Zachariah Sitchin's work, it turns out she is a part of the party of beings that came from the stars to create the worker race of humans that we are. So she is much more than just a story. Mm-hmm. She's actually, I mean, her story goes way farther.
So she's the daughter of Enki. And Enki
She's not directly the daughter, but he kind of calls her his daughter. But there is a genealogy, and you can look at it and see who she comes from and everything. But it really, the truth is, see, what's been so staggering to me and really keeps happening at a more and more amazing level is to find out that things that I've never dreamed would be related are related, and that the story, so Inanna, I got interested in Inanna on a whole separate vein. Somebody gave me an article from the Palladians, and I read it, and I was so blown away by what they said about relationships that I began to know that there must be such a thing. There must be people or beings, and so I was interested in the Palladians. I was interested in Inanna, but I had no idea there was a through line between them, right? And then just more recently, I have been a cannabis sacrament minister for about 12 years, and what that means to me is that I'm teaching the sacred use of Mary, and I'm asking people to acknowledge and begin to change the name of what they call the cannabis plant, because I believe it is the divine feminine that comes through that plant.
You want to change the name of the cannabis plant from marijuana to...
I just want people to call it Mary. You know,
without the wana.
Without the
I think marijuana is Mary Jane in Spanish, right? Is that
yeah,
marijuana?
That's what that is. But I want to take the Juana out or the Jane out and take advantage of the fact that in Western culture, the name Mary happens to reference Mary the Mother, happens to reference Mary Magdalene, and can also represent this plant, because that's what I believe is how the Divine Feminine is coming. What is the Divine Feminine? She is Mary the Mother. She is that energy that gives us life, that nurtures life, that feeds us and cares for us, the comforting, reassuring aspect of the feminine. She is also Mary the Lover, which is Mary Magdalene, which is the dynamic, transformative feminine that will sacrifice that which is most dear to her in order to produce necessary change. So she's the mysterious, unknown, unknowable feminine, the sexual, the mystery of woman, and that's one of the ways the Divine Feminine comes. And it's not the reassuring feminine, it's the scary feminine, but it's the exciting feminine. And then she comes through Mary the plant, which is providing all of our needs, because that plant, the seed of that plant, is the only seed that contains every amino acid needed by man to survive. It also is, you know, the hemp plant, which provides everything we need physically. So that plant meets our spiritual, sexual, emotional, and physical needs.
But don't you think people get too addicted to that use?
Absolutely. But guess why? We're living in a culture of repression. So when you say, just say no, then you can't K-N-O-W. So what we need is not suppression. We need education. Because once you get education, then you won't have this misuse. You know,
so how's Inanna connected?
Well, I'll tell you, that's another amazing thing, is that, and this just happened literally this month, if you can imagine.
Everything's accelerating.
Yeah. Well, the tying it all together, I feel like I'm living in an absolutely outrageous story where, you know, you were talking about a walk-in, and I asked Rajaka, you know, maybe I'm a walk-in. I don't know.
You might be Inanna herself.
I may be a walk-in here. I'm not sure. I mean, there's certainly, you would ask my children, and they would tell you that I stopped being a mother in the way that, you know, I had been before once this happened. I mean, I love my children. I'm a great, great mother. But I stopped having my life be about my home and my children. I began to let my life be about being this energy and carrying this energy. And felt that that was really what...
Have you channeled Inanna? Has she come to you directly? I'm just curious.
I can show you a video where you will feel that presence. And I have many things that I've written that are written through from her. I mean, it's not exactly like where you go, okay, now I'm going to channel and she comes through. It's not like that. It's very hard for me quite to distinguish what's me and what's her. But when I read things that I've written in the years past when it was most happening, I don't remember writing those things. And they were never written from my logical mind. I never sat down to write them. I you know, for example, the sensuous woman's workout. I thought I was walking out the door of my bedroom, and the next thing I knew, I had a microphone in my hand, and I was recording the sensuous woman's workout.
Is that your book?
It's actually a video.
Oh, it is. Now, is there a different quality between Tara, Mary, and Nana? Is there a different quality to the feminine in each of these archetypes?
I have come to believe that the energy of Mary, that is the energy that I speak of in the plant, is so profoundly connected to Inanna, because this is what I was going to say. In fact, I'm going to send you to my room one more time, my dear friend, and grab the book on green gold, if you will.
Thank you.
This is what I was saying is, you know, as a cannabis sacrament minister, I had no idea there was a connection between that and Inanna until just this month, when I am starting to launch something called The Truth About Mary, where I feel that if we, you know, many people are becoming aware of the value of hemp to our world, and fortunately we finally now are moving into a time where hemp's going to be able to be grown in America.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then many people are telling the truth about the healing qualities of marijuana. And
the oil, especially.
Oh, I have been someone who is up close and personal with the huge healing of this plant.
Mm-hmm.
And to have anybody doubt it or question it is just ignorance and avoidance of the truth, because you cannot doubt it. So that truth about its healing properties is being told, and the truth about its practical properties is being told. But the truth that I'm trying to get told is the difference she makes spiritually, the difference she makes sexually, the difference she makes in our relationships. Because as a woman who had an amazing 20-year marriage, my husband died in 2001, but our marriage, in 20 years, every time we made love, it was a never-before-experienced experience. Every time. And that, I know, was partly a function of the support that cannabis gave us to our bodies. Because as a dancer, I'm telling you, and any other dancer who is familiar with Mary will say the same thing. You can get into your body deeper with Mary. So
mm-hmm.
the same thing is true. You can get deeper into your sexuality. And so to speak about that is important. Nobody's really speaking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Then the higher thing that's probably as important, more important, is that marijuana elevates your consciousness, and it will allow you to get out of your personal point of view and see things from a higher perspective. So in the marriage experience, you need to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And to my, I've got a suitcase back there full of notes, and we taught, of course, through all of our conversations, we taught an amazing course. And there's an interview that I told you about, which I'll make available mm-hmm. to people, that many people say has changed their lives. But it is really filled with the wisdom that came from our conversations on Mary that allowed us to observe the dynamics that we were in as two human beings, but do it from a spiritual alignment that didn't stand across from each other and throw arrows at each other, but help, you know, work together to see what we could see. How were we as two human beings getting caught in the maya of it all? So
what's the connection between marijuana and Inanna, the ancient goddess?
Who would guess that there was anything?
Yes, exactly.
So here I am on page 7 of this book, which I'm just reading.
It's a very well underlined book, I want to tell people.
So in this book, on page 7, I mean, first of all, when I opened this book, it didn't start off talking about marijuana like I thought it was. It started off talking about Sumeria. So let's just say that in itself staggered me.
What the name of the book is?
The name of the book is Green Gold, The Tree of Life, Marijuana and Magic and Religion.
Okay.
And it's by Chris Bennett, Lynn Osborne, and Judy Osborne. So it starts off, and it takes us right back into the very, you know, ancient Mesopotamia,
mm-hmm.
the first chapter. We're going back into Sumeria.
Mm-hmm.
And what it says right here is that, okay, so remember Eridu is where Enki is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the first mound of earth that arose from the sweet water was called Eridu, the Mound of Creation, by the Sumerians. It was the most sacred place in all of antiquity, and the Sumerians built a shrine atop the Mound of Eridu, and from there, kingship and the arts of civilization were revealed to them. So this is the myth about the kingship and arts of civilization. Mm-hmm. And here they are talking about it in my book on marijuana.
Okay.
That got my attention, right?
Yeah.
And then it says, the old legends claim that the Sumerians ate the fruit from the tree of knowledge at Eridu. Now, the tree of knowledge, see, we could say that hemp is the tree of life. It meets all of our needs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Mary is the tree of knowledge, because what Mary does is she gives you the perspective that lets you see beyond, you know, the limited point of view. So here we say, the old legends claim the Sumerians ate the fruit from the tree of knowledge at Eridu. The inspiration given them carried both joy and sorrow, for the revelation of the arts of civilization and the divine power of kingship, which is political organization, had to be accepted in totality, and once accepted can never be rejected. In other words, what they're saying is, if you are living an unconscious, basically animalistic kind of life where you don't have the arts of civilization,
mm-hmm.
and then all of a sudden you eat from the tree of knowledge and you realize there is such a way of governing yourself and people so that we can be in harmony,
mm-hmm.
so that there's political organization and there is such a thing as right and wrong. Once you get the idea of right and wrong out of eating, you know, out of eating the plant,
mm-hmm.
right, you can't go back from that. You can't return. Once you get right and wrong into you, you cannot go back to ignorance of right and wrong, right?
Exactly.
Because there's both joy and sorrow in that, because you can just be pretty selfish and mm-hmm. you know, have your own way if you don't have that in you. But now we are, as a human species, we've now got right and wrong, and we've got the arts of civilization. So here's the next chapter, the next paragraph. With the knowledge revealed to them, they conceived the first Mesopotamian city at Uruk.
That was Inanna City.
The first thing they built at Uruk was a ziggurat, or temple, dedicated to the goddess Inanna.
Mm.
Okay, let's just say that staggered me. Mm-hmm. Here I am, I'm just reading a book about marijuana to get more familiar with a subject matter I'm passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea it connects to Inanna. And here it is, the very first thing that God built after they got the concept of good and evil.
But where's marijuana show up in that?
Well, this is, marijuana is the tree of knowledge.
Oh.
Okay, this is what they're telling you about this, is that this is, and so the whole...
One of the
arts of civilization revealed to the Sumerians was the art of writing. So now we're going to step a little back. Let's say that what really happened is that Inanna and Gilgamesh and the whole the landing party from the Palladians comes down,
mm-hmm.
brings marijuana. See, you know, the cannabis, the word cannabis, I just found this out. Canna means dog. This is two. It's the Egyptian word for the two-dog star, which mm-hmm. is Sirius, which is where marijuana comes from.
Wait.
I'm not kidding you.
Cannabis, I get the cane part.
This. And so cannabis, the origins of cannabis, and do you know that hemp is the only fiber that twists to the left and not the right? And
so you say marijuana was brought to the earth from Sirius, the star.
Exactly, the two-star.
That's new.
Isn't that amazing?
I think that's new for everyone listening to BBS, yeah. Okay.
Here I am, this woman who's given my life up to Inanna, and on a whole other level has sort of given my life up to Mary, and, you know, on a whole nother level is interested in the Palladians. And all of a sudden, the whole thing's coming together. Inanna's a Palladian, that, you know, Sirius is a star in that system. Cannabis is brought to Earth by the Palladians through Inanna to civilize the Earth people. And they bring in writing as the very first thing they do. And you know, the very first author we know who wrote, there was writing, but you didn't know who wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
The first writing we know who wrote it is from a priestess named Enheduanna, who was a priestess in the temple of Inanna.
Mm-hmm.
So the first author that we actually know who wrote anything is, in you know, a part of the anonymous.
Yeah.
So, you know.
So well, how does this book proceed? I'm just curious because it talks about the ancient world, talks about the, you know, celebration of the goddess, and then how does it get into marijuana and magic? And so it just says throughout history we've used these sacred substances to create ceremonies and tune in.
You know, I have just begun to read this book,
all right.
So I don't know the answer to that. But let's just read what it says right here. It says, the essence of the awakening. Okay, we'll read a little bit. One of the arts of civilization revealed to the Sumerians was the art of writing. They used writing primarily to record the volume of trade in their economy, but they also wrote down their religious beliefs, myths, and legends. These beliefs and legends, which they wrote down, the oldest yet deciphered, are based upon a rich oral tradition going back to the Great Awakening. The term here used to describe the condition when the human psyche first experienced self-reflection, possibly initiated by some catalytic occurrence when the human brain evolved enough neurons to process the elements of sound into words with meaning. So we're awakening, you know what I say, in the beginning was the word, right?
Mm-hmm.
So once we begin to make words that have meaning, now we can get self-reflection. The point of awakening for humanity was to our ancient ancestors the creation of man. From the point of awakening onward, they grappled with the same religious mysteries that confront us today, though we believe ourselves to be some 6,000 or more years to the wisest.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the essence of...
What's
the,
that quote, though?
Okay, this is an unknown quote from the mystical Kabbalah. For no thought of man made gods to love and honor ere the song within the silent soul began. Nor night, nor might earth in dream or deed take heaven upon her, till the word was clothed with speech by lips of man. So that's basically about language.
Right, and language actually creates reality.
Creates reality.
And creates who we are, you know, our understanding of ourselves, our understanding of the world, yeah.
So let's read this, since I have a star by it. It says, the essence of the awakening necessarily includes a condition of self-awareness functioning through a process of self-reflection. Two of the consequences of self-awareness and self-reflection are realization of others and apprehension of the unknown. See, for a dog, there is no unknown.
Mm.
And there's other, but not other like we experience other. There's no...
Well, let me take that. The essence of the awakening necessarily includes a condition of self-awareness functioning through a process of self-reflection, right? Self-awareness, self-reflection. Two of the consequences of self-awareness and self-reflection are the realization of the other, that's something outside of us, and an apprehension of the unknown. So it gives us a present experience with an awareness that there's more that unfolds in each present moment, the unknown. The unknown's always unfolding
first
in the present.
First, it gives you an awareness of yourself. Your dog has self-awareness. It's
right.
Not thinking about itself, right?
Or others.
Or others.
Yeah, yeah.
So first of all, you get the awareness of self, and then you get self-observation,
mm-hmm.
which allows you to keep evolving that self, right? So you get the awareness of self, the awareness of other, and self-observation that allows you to begin to interact with the other in an evolutionary way. So that is still, somebody asked me, what does it mean to be conscious? I say it means to self-observe. Basically, that's the bottom line for me, is once you're self-observing, you are in the process of consciousness.
But I want to add one thing to that. I mean, it's a little off the topic, but when that's wiped out, when that self-awareness and self-identification is wiped out, you know what's left is still expression, still creativity, still the art of being. That's even after all the ego identification is erased, there's still a need to express and experience.
You know, I'll tell you what rose up in me as you spoke about that.
Mm-hmm.
I have not had much exposure to children who have Down syndrome,
mm-hmm.
but I have been told that the love that they give and mm-hmm. evoke is an astonishing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I doubt that they have self observation
mm-hmm.
in the same way, right? But they are expressing. and they are experiencing. So I hear that.
Well, that's our basic, I think, human essence. Even before the Great Awakening, as they say, this idea of self-reflection, we had an idea of self-expression. I think, you know, the primitive foragers and hunters, their head was the earth. You know, they didn't have an awareness of me. Their whole identity was everything out there. Mm. But even in that, there was a need to express experience. And that's where writing comes from. Writing just doesn't come out of anywhere. It comes, and speaking, the need for words. Where's the need for words? It comes from our innate human ability to want to express and communicate with each other. Anyway, that's
okay.
A little side thing. Okay.
So let's just read this last piece. This results in the religious attempt to define self and explain the unknown. So, you know, religion has been trying to explain where we came from and what happens afterwards. That's basically the essence of religion. So in this experience that was catalyzed by marijuana, the religious quest comes forth, okay? So we could keep going into this, but here's where I'm going to take us next.
Okay.
I'm taking us back to the love story.
That is a great book. I just want to say this: Green Gold, The Tree of Life, Marijuana and the Magic, In Magic and Religion. Looks like a very interesting book.
You know,
when was this written?
Let's see, when was this written? This was written...
1995, it looks like, back there.
Yeah. 1995, and there was one thing in here that I was going to show you where they said that the mushroom, the Amanita muscaria, I can't really say that word, but you know that mushroom I'm talking about?
Yeah.
How do you say that mushroom?
Hallucinogenic mushrooms?
Yeah, it actually, they say in here that is really believed to be the origins of consciousness in humanity.
That's what Terrence McKenna said.
Yeah, that's
right.
I know his work, not well, but I do, you know.
Yeah.
So that's a whole other story. But
okay, we'll go back to Inanna. It's just interesting. I think we're in, it's not necessarily something I do, but a marijuana revolution with these states in the country legalizing it.
What I say is it is a reflection of how we treat the divine feminine. That Mary is illegal. Because, first of all, the only reason Mary is illegal is because it's a money. You know, we were just reading and watching something that hemp was such a part of our culture that nobody would have been able to pass a law making hemp illegal. So what they did instead, and when I say they, I'm talking about William Randolph Hearst and the Monsanto Corporation and somebody else that I don't remember who it was, but basically the paper industry, the plastic industry and the cotton industry were the ones threatened. There was no way to harvest hemp economically until all of a sudden in the 30s there was a machine invented that made it possible, and those industries got threatened. And so what happened was, and we just ended prohibition, so you had this whole, all these people whose jobs had been enforcing prohibition, now they're out of work. So now they make the Reefer Madness film. They make up a word called marijuana. They say that it's this bad drug from Mexico and that the Mexicans are coming in and raping the white women. And they lump hemp in with it and pass a law that people don't even realize is happening that makes marijuana illegal and also makes hemp illegal. But the wool was pulled over our eyes because nobody realized what they were really voting on. So that was an economic conspiracy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the actual, what I say, is the real reason that marijuana is illegal and people are so afraid of it is because it is the divine feminine.
Mm-hmm.
People will not be caught up in a world of producing and consuming goods. If they are smoking marijuana more or using marijuana more, they will be happier out in the park listening to music. They'll be dancing. They'll be making love. They will not be in the rat race that has us seeking satisfaction from things we're never going to get it from. And so it is completely consistent with our puritanical and patriarchal roots that anything that produces ecstasy and connection and satisfaction is going to be illegal because our economy is run on being insanely unsatisfied and looking for satisfaction in the purchasing process. So, and our morality is based on suppression of the body and the suppression of pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only pleasure, watch what's happening in our world right now.
Mm-hmm.
The only pleasure we are allowing people is food. Have you seen the obesity that's happening in our culture? And then that fuels the industry, that's the health industry.
Mm.
As long as you keep Mary out of the health industry, then you...
How would you fit marijuana into the health, or Mary into the health industry? How would you connect that?
So it's happening right now. You know, we're finally recognizing that marijuana is a solution. Is it, does heal cancer, does heal the children who are having these horrible seizures. And if you watch the movie Leaf, L-E-A-F, on YouTube, you'll see a man that I know, Dr. William Courtney, who treated a young woman who had lupus and was dying, and she's now his wife, and they have a child, and she's radiantly healthy, and it happened by him taking the leaves of the marijuana plant and juicing them like you do wheatgrass,
mm-hmm.
and he put her on every 2 hours, 2 ounces of juice. And in 6 weeks, all of her symptoms were gone, and she was radiantly back in health. And this is the one
by
that was
drinking
on,
the juice.
By drinking
the juice.
Does
that make you high?
No, it doesn't make you high at all.
It doesn't?
No, not a bit. It's full of CBD. It has nothing to do with the THC in the flower.
Oh, you know, I met the guy who isolated cannabinoids in marijuana. He's an Israeli biologist, botanist, and... he talked about the health benefits of that and how it's been.
Well,
right.
Dr. Courtney says marijuana is actually a vegetable. It's not even an herb. We need it in our bodies. And the reason we're having such a, it used to be in our cereal. Hemp seed was just a natural part of our food. Well, all this huge, what is it that people, my father has it, it's Parkinson's disease. And so many Alzheimer's. Those are diseases that were not prevalent so long ago, and they are prevalent because it's missing. It's like we have a deficiency. We have a hemp deficiency, you know, cannabis deficiency.
So getting back to Inanna.
Okay, let's go back to that.
Okay.
I hope you're having a good time. I have no idea how much time we've got.
No, we have a little bit of time, but we have another, like, 10, 15 minutes or something.
Well, now we're going to go back to the language before sexual shame. Okay?
But before we do that, can you tell people how to find you if they're listening? Is there an email or a website? Is there something?
Okay. The website, truthaboutmary.com, is coming into existence. It will be there by the time you hear this. There will be a landing page.
Okay.
So you can start there.
Well, they're hearing it now. But anyway.
Okay, good.
Actually, yes.
And you can also, you know, if you really want to get in touch with me immediately, you are welcome to send me an email to thegoddessalive@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go to thegoddessalive.com. And so you can't go to Goddess Alive. You've got to go to thegoddessalive.com. And you will see me and a little bit of like a story of me.
Mm. Do you know about Run from the Cure?
That
whole thing?
I totally do.
Okay, I know about that. Marijuana oil is very key in helping people heal.
It's amazing.
Back to Inanna.
Okay, so this is the world's first love story, and it has application to our lives if you study this story. And then the last myth is the one most people know about, which is the descent of Inanna. It's the first story of a deity intentionally going into the underworld through the death process, being hung on a peg for 3 days to rot, and then coming out through resurrection. So with the first resurrection story, the first love story, the first male-female combat story, these are the stories that are lost to our world and that are now being reclaimed. So this is me sharing with you the story of the world's first love story. And in this story, Inanna was the queen of her people, and the king became king by marrying the queen.
Mm-hmm.
And her people selected a shepherd for her to marry.
Oh, the people select the king for the queen.
That's right.
Well, that's very democratic of them.
Well, I'm not sure if the people, but it wasn't her.
Okay.
She didn't get to say.
Oh, she didn't.
It might have been her parents, it was people, but somebody, not her, she wanted to marry a farmer like herself.
Mm-hmm.
But no, they picked a shepherd. And so he had to woo her. And he would say things, if the farmer gives you this, I will give you that. And finally he won her, right? And this is the part that I love, when she's finally accepted his suit, okay? So Inanna ran to Ningal, the mother who bore her. Ningal counseled her daughter, saying, "My child, the young man will be your father. My daughter, the young man will be your mother. He will treat you like a father. He will care for you like a mother. Open the house, my lady. Open the house." Now, interestingly, in the Bible, when you talk about opening the gate or opening the house or opening the door, it's actually got a correspondence to opening your vagina. Opening yourself sexually. There's that implication.
Wait, where's that in the Bible?
Yeah, I remember reading the in my studies of the Bible a long time ago, one of the things that they talked about was the shepherd, the gate, the sheepfold was also anonymous. I mean, not
synonymous.
Synonymous with your body. But so this is the story. Inanna, at her mother's command, bathed and anointed herself with scented oil. She covered her body with a royal white robe. She readied her dowry. She arranged her precious lapis beads around her neck. She took her seal in her hand. Dumuzi waited expectantly. Inanna opened the door for him.
You mean the vagina door?
Well, we don't know.
Would think that's what it meant there.
But
yeah.
Let's watch what
okay.
she says. Inside the house, she shone before him like the light of the moon. Dumuzi looked at her joyously. He pressed his neck close against hers. He kissed her. Inanna spoke, "What I tell you, let the singer weave into song. What I tell you, let it flow from ear to mouth. Let it pass from old to young. My vulva, the horn, the boat of heaven, is full of eagerness like the young moon. My untilled land lies fallow. As for me, Inanna, who will plow my vulva? Who will plow my high field? Who will plow my wet ground? As for me, the young woman, who will plow my vulva? Who will station the ox there? Who will plow my vulva?" Dumuzi replied, "Great lady, the king will plow your vulva. I, Dumuzi the king, will plow your vulva. Then plow my vulva, man of my heart. Plow my vulva." Well, I just went, okay, she got my vote. Nobody talks like this.
Mm-hmm.
I love these times. Mm-hmm. That's what happened to me when I read this. I just thought, wow.
So you plowed her vulva. Huh?
I guess so.
I'm going to have to use that expression.
And, and it's true that the fun part of this story, I don't know the fun part, but the interesting part is that they make love and love and love, and it's just constant, right?
Mm-hmm.
And finally, at the end, he says, he says, "Let me go. I've got to go tend to the kingdom. Stop. You're just going to keep me in bed forever," basically. So it's an interesting story because
he laid me down on the fragrant honey bed.
He laid me down on the fragrant honey bed, my sweet love lying by my heart, tongue playing one by one. My fair Dumuzi did so 50 times. Now my sweet love is sated. Now he says, "Set me free, my sister, set me free." See, he turns her right here from a lover into a sister and a daughter. You know how that happens in marriage?
Yeah, I guess it
does.
It does.
It happens, right? Mm-hmm. So he says, "You will be a little daughter to my father. Come, my beloved sister. I would go to the palace. Set me free." And she says, "Ah, my blossom bearer, your allure was sweet. My blossom bearer in the apple orchard, my bearer of fruit, Dumuzi Abzu, your allure was sweet. My fearless one, my holy statue, my statue outfitted with sword and lapis lazuli, how sweet was your allure."
Mm.
So she's feeling the loss, right? Because now he's off being king.
He's off being king. Yeah.
And what happens in the next myth that's really wonderful, which we can't get into, but
right.
It's The Descent of Inanna, and basically this is the story that the world is now studying. It's being taught in some of the universities and stuff, and we'll just talk about this one in another time, okay?
All right. Well, she goes into, no, that sounds interesting. She goes into the underworld and comes out a kind of more awakened.
He comes out with the knowledge of the underworld. And it's a wonderful story, but the part that I was going to say to you, which is so interesting and ties to this, is when she returns, she can't leave the underworld without replacing herself. So they send a guard with her till she replaces herself. And she goes out looking for somebody to replace herself, and everybody is mourning her death. Everybody's in mourning, and she can't send them. And she looks and looks for somebody that she can send. And it's not till she finds Dumuzi, her husband, who's so carried away being king, he hasn't even noticed what's happened to her. And she says, oh, my love, it's you.
He has
to go into the underworld.
To get her.
No, to replace her. She's emerged from the underworld, but he's going to have to go down because he's the only one who isn't even noticing that she was gone. He's so in his egoic process as king.
So he goes to the underworld and she emerges out.
She emerges out. Well, he runs away. When she finds him and he tells her that, he runs. And she and his half-sister, Geshtinana, pursue him. And Geshtinana finally, in the end, when they finally trap him and he can't get away from him, Geshtinana says, look, I'll go 6 months of the year, and you go 6 months of the year. So Geshtinana is the new feminine, the compassionate feminine, and she decides she'll split it with him. So, that's a whole story.
Interesting, this Inanna.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes. How does that connect to, marijuana, you're saying, is the feminine. Inanna is the root for Western civilization of the divine feminine. How do we take that all now into today's time? Yes.
Okay. So I am launching a site which is not yet up called Mythica Via, which means the mythic way. And really what I think is possible is for us to begin to recognize that we are mythic beings. We are not the stories we have. You are Alan this time, but you've been amazing other beings And we're multidimensional, so who knows even the Alan that's existing on other levels.
Or maybe you are the divine feminine itself, incarnating into this limited personality, but who you really are is the divine feminine.
And I know that that's true, and it's not just true of me. In other words, when I'm working with people, what I'm always asking them to do is step out of their story into their glory. And I do it by taking you out of structured clothing. See, once you're wearing clothing that's been manufactured, you are in a world where time equals money and where you are in a world of fashion, where fashion is changing and you're keeping up with the fashion and you have to keep consuming new things and all of that. If you notice, I wear robes.
I like wearing sarong. I like wearing nothing, actually.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, in my world, the men wear togas and let their chests and arms show, and the women wear, wraps, like goddess wraps. And what it does is it immediately lets you go into the archetypal world instead of the story, the personal history world. So you don't have to talk about how your father did whatever or the divorces you've had. If you can actually get that who you are is a divine being and that this whole story that you're living is your creation and it's designed to get you to a place where you actually wake up to it being your creation, then who created that story is this archetypal self. And you can start to connect with each other that way. It's so much more fun to dress you up like a king and be like a goddess and be with each other that way than to sit down over dinner and share our stories of wounding and pathology. My God, could we stop that?
So the real primal self starts to the real self, the authentic self, the natural self, and the embodiment of that, separate from the cultural conditioning that has wanted to put us in boxes.
Right.
And so men and women start to merge together again and be...
And this brings us to the practices. So I actually teach amazing practices that allow you to stay connected at that level.
Tell me about them.
Well, one of the most fundamental is, uh, it's eye-gazing and breath-kissing at the exact same time while you're horizontal in a particular position that allows you to fully relax, to go into unity with your eyes through, you know, very, very close. You can't even see the person anymore. Mm-hmm. You don't see them as a person with beauty or whatever. You see you're in a third eye to third eye engagement with each other, and you can see the spiritual self, mm-hmm. and you can feel it. And it's like a shared meditation. It's actually the fastest way I know to get out of your mind and into the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So in the horizontal eye gazing and breath kissing process, where you are actually putting your mouth together, keeping your tongue back, your eyes are open, and you're breathing in and out of each other's body, I'm telling you, there is euphoria in there, and there is something in it. The word inspire means take spirit in.
Mm-hmm.
Spirit is actually, there's something in the air out here that is the spirit of every person who's ever lived. It's called argon. And when you breathe, you're breathing in the spirit of everybody who ever lived.
Mm-hmm.
It's mixing with your spirit, and you exhale, and everybody gets a little bit of you. So we're breathing each other, and we're breathing Christ, and we're breathing Genghis Khan, and we're breathing Buddha every single time we breathe. When you breath kiss the way that I teach, you get a super dose of each other's spirit.
Mm.
And you're in spiritual vision with each other. You're breathing each other's spirit. And if couples would do that one spiritual song a day, every day, like a practice, I say it would cut the divorce rate in half.
Mm-hmm. So you teach, that's one of the practices you teach. Do you teach with couples? Is that your...
I teach anybody who wants to learn, you know.
Okay.
Sometimes it's a couple, sometimes it's a woman, sometimes it's a man. Mm-hmm. A lot of the time I am specifically teaching men new ways to be with a woman, that new ways to hug a woman, new ways to hold a woman, new ways to move with a woman, mm-hmm. that allow her body to get the self-experiences of safety, belonging, surrender, trust, adoration, the feelings women are so starved to have, and that men are starved to have, too.
Yeah.
So there's, when you shift out of, you know, being in your identity, creating identities, sitting down and using, most everybody is, when you try to, you know, if you think about what people are doing when they go out with each other, they are going out to dinner, sitting and eating and talking. They're going to a bar, sitting and drinking and talking. They're going to a movie, sitting and watching somebody else talk. It's all, none of it's physical, and none of it is emotional, really. It's a story, and you're just trading identities in there. And so then the only thing they do after that is they go get liquid, start liquid kissing, and then go to sex. And there's a whole world that I teach that's beyond liquid.
What do you mean, liquid kissing? What does that mean?
Well, see, the minute your tongue's involved, your body's having a chemical reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, oh, I know where this goes. Let's go.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts a push to go to genital sexuality.
Mm-hmm. So, and people rush into that too fast.
They rush into it, and they miss. And very often, genital sexuality leaves you feeling alone and separate and not trusting and not all the things that we want to feel rarely happen in that experience.
So you have to, you say hold off tongue kissing before. So what do you do before that?
Breath kissing.
Breath kissing.
And you do all this new kind of movement that's down on the floor, that's core connection, that gets you connect. Remember we started talking last night about the continuum concept and the need for the body to have belonging.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole, you know, we're racing here to the end of this.
No, it's okay. Yeah, no,
all
it's
right.
Okay.
Well, what I would say about this, these are like my favorite conversations.
Okay.
Is that for most of humanity's history, we have been a nomadic species, and we're one of the few nomadic species that cannot get up and run with the tribe when we're born.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Giraffes have to get up on those gangly legs and run.
All the animals.
All of them.
Yeah.
We are like a little baby kangaroo when we're born. We can barely function. We need to be tied on a pouch and carried for the first 2 years of our lives, for thousands of years, right? And so we learn that we are safe and we are loved and we belong by being up against the belly or the back of somebody. And it doesn't matter who the person is.
Mm-hmm.
If they will carry you, you belong with them.
And you are nurtured by that connection. Yeah.
And now the white race has hundreds of years of babies in cribs and strollers, never naked on anybody's body.
Never being held.
Never being carried by the mother, brother, sister, grandma, aunt, just maybe by the mother. So our bodies are in shock. Where is my belonging?
So we crave...
We crave the core connection.
And we and when we get it, we don't know what to do with it, right? Because there's you know, we're not used to it. We're stuck for it.
I don't feel like people don't know what to do with it. People start sighing. They start, you know, the minute you put, put a man down, laying face down on a silk floor, which is what I like to work on, and nestle your waist into his back and start letting your weight go down upon him, and he will start moaning with the joy of the weight.
Mm.
We need weight from each other. We need so much more touch and weight and deep connection, not the surface connection that's titillating you because you actually feel separate, but the weight that is so deep that you feel you are sharing weight. You are sharing the muscle-bone-nerve connection. So there's so much creativity and beauty. I'm actually doing something called Beauty and Strength. I want people to start exploring power and glory of beauty and strength with each other. And it happens standing up and down on the floor. And it's just a whole other way for people to connect. And it's a great way for singles to connect because the singles don't have, all they've got is this talk world and the sex world. And really, there's this whole world in the middle that if you start enjoying that world, you won't be as lonely. Mm-hmm. You'll have a lot of your needs for touch met. Mm-hmm. You'll have community.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll eventually have love, but you won't be so starved for it. You won't make so many bad decisions.
Mm-hmm. It's more tantric in a way.
But
you're expanding that into a whole other realm. I think we should just about wrap up. But how can people find you again? And thank you so much for sharing all your research, all yourself, all your love, all the wisdom that you want to hand to the world
so they
can be better people.
Thank you. It's my joy and privilege. Thank you so much.
So how can people find you?
Well, probably the very best thing is to email me right now, and that is thegoddessalive@gmail.com.
Right. And I've been talking to Alora Inanna here in lovely Marina Del Rey, not far from the airport.
And a block from the ocean. That's the best part.
A block from the ocean in her lovely, lovely temple home. And we'll do some video interviews. And if you want to reach me, I'm at newrealities.com. I'm Steinfeld. You can also email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thanks for listening, and I welcome comments about this program or any of the other programs in the New Reality series. Thanks for listening.